Well, good morning again. Welcome, welcome. I have announcements for you. The first being that next Sunday is Easter, and we will have two services next Sunday, one at 9 o'clock and one at 11 o'clock a.m. We will have a full kids program at both of those, so whatever works best for you and your family, but we are excited to celebrate with you. And then we have that. The following week, on April 7th, we're going to gather together here in this space for a brunch during church. That happens at 10:30 a.m. And we are looking for some people that might be willing and able to make our, we just call it the Brookview casserole, because it's the same one every time. Why reinvent when something can go so well? So maybe someday we'll get sick of that. But you guys, I've eaten the same lunch for like over a year now. And it usually takes me about 5 years to get sick of my lunch. So we have a long ways to go on this casserole. Some of you are like, wow, that's unsettling. Don't worry, I change it up for dinner. You guys, I go crazy. But my breakfast and my lunch, exactly the same. Okay, that's enough about me. If you can help with that, if you could text the word brunch to that number there. And I feel like I forgot to, like, have it automatically push you the casserole, but maybe it will, and it just has the wrong date. So disregard all of that. Just still do the thing, and I'll find you somewhere in the, okay. If you know me also, you can email me if that's easier for you as well. Or email brookviewchurchbriar@gmail.com. So that is the week after Easter we get together. And then as a really cool part of that, we get to have baptisms and celebrate people's decision to say yes to God in their lives. And so if that is you, where you're just like, I don't know where I'm at with that, and I feel like maybe, we would love to hear from you. So simply text the word baptism to that number. You can also fill out the connect card that is on your seat. And even if you're like, I'm not sure, but I would want some more information, Jason will be so excited to connect with you and just to talk with you about that. And we as a church family cannot wait to get together and to celebrate baptisms. That is a really special, cool thing we get to do together. We have soccer club that's coming up in July, and I think I said last week we had like 106 kids. We're at 142 this morning, and so you can sign your kids up for that. You can invite your friends to do that. We're going to go ahead and ignorance is bliss. We're just going to keep that open, and I'm not going to look at it for a little while until I get a better volunteer team in place. That didn't happen this week, but if you would like to volunteer to help with soccer club, that information is not there. So see that website right there? All that you add is volunteer to the back of it. Soccer volunteer, all one word. So if you want to sign up for that, you can do that online, or you can do it on your Connect card as well, and I will get in touch with you sometime next week. Connect card, that's it. Did I do it, Brooklyn? Yes. Okay, connect cards, I've already referred to them. If you're watching online today, would you go online at brookviewchurch.com and fill one of those out, and we'll be excited to hear from you.
Well, you guys, we're kind of winding down this series. We're thinking about hearing God amidst all the noise in our world because there's so many voices shouting to us the way, right? Telling us what the good life looks like, telling us who we are, telling us what it is that makes us valuable or not. So how do we hear the voice of the God who loves us through all of that? And so we've been thinking about this since January, and we have 2 weeks left. Okay, so we'll talk more today, and then we're going to wrap this up completely next week on Easter. And if you're thinking, I was thinking about inviting somebody, is it like going to be good? We'll see. So, you guys, last week was pretty sweet for me. For 15 years, Bryce has been coming down from Arlington to Brookview. As I said last week, he's preached here 24 times over that span. And as he said farewell last week, I have never in my life seen him that emotional. It was really a special morning for our church, I think. And so I want to update you guys on Bryce. As of Sunday morning at church last week, his move to Nebraska was likely, but still up in the air. So he did his interview in the afternoon, right after he spoke here, and the board at the church in Nebraska unanimously voted to bring him on. So good for him, yeah. So he's going to fly back in April, he thought, lock down some housing, and then kind of move there permanently in June. But I think you guys, I think Bryce has really felt the love from you guys for many years. It was never hard for me to get him to come here to speak with you. And I actually was really surprised at how hard it was for him to say goodbye. I mean, clearly this little church community is very special to him. So it was a really, really sweet Sunday, wasn't it? It was. Okay, so what I want to do, though, is take you back to where we left off 2 weeks ago. In Matthew chapters 5-7, Jesus gives what we now call the Sermon on the Mount. It's basically his manifesto on a totally new way to be human, how to participate in God's kingdom both now and forevermore. And in it, Jesus says some really radical stuff that's kind of become cliche in our culture, stuff like turn the other cheek, go the extra mile, give the shirt off your back. Jesus talks about becoming love so thoroughly that we learn to love even our enemies. Talks about becoming people of the deepest integrity, people who let go of hate and anger and bitterness and judgment of one another, people who learn to experience sexuality to the fullest but without objectifying and oppressing one another. Talks about finding freedom from the addiction of impressing people, learning to live with confidence and faith, letting go of worry and anxiety. Talks about learning to love our neighbors as deeply as we love ourselves. And he says, this is life in the kingdom. And it is available right here, right now. And entering this way of living is what will heal us and what will heal our world. But at the end of the sermon, Jesus gives us three warnings. So 2 weeks ago, we looked at the first two. Number one is choose the narrow road, not the wide road. And then number two was watch out for false prophets. In other words, choose carefully who you let instruct you about life. And today we're going to look at his third and final warning. So this is the conclusion for the most influential speech in human history. A speech that has deeply imprinted our world. Are you guys ready for this? Here we go. You can judge for yourself whether or not Jesus is a motivational speaker. Here's what he says. The end of the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Sermon over. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Now, you guys, this is really an unusual and extraordinary way to end a sermon, and I'll show you why as we go this morning. And before we work through it today, I want to say I'm indebted to a guy named John Mark Comer for his insights on kind of how this passage meets our culture. So to begin, I want us to think about how much the world has changed from Jesus' day to ours. And I want to start by giving you three ideas about the modern world. Three ideas from three key thinkers over the last few decades. Okay, first, we have Buckminster Fuller, who started as an architect, and he invented the geodesic dome. Any of you been to Disney World? Oh, yeah. And he went on to become a futurist and a systems theorist. And in his book, Critical Path, he came up with what he called the knowledge doubling curve. So he estimated that from the year of Jesus' birth, it took 1,500 years for the cumulative knowledge in all human civilization to double. But from there, it only took 250 years for it to double again. From there, it doubled every 100 years up to World War II. After that, it doubled every 25 years until the 90s, where it doubled every 12 to 13 months. And now, most estimates, depending on which strategist you read, you guys, it doubles every 12 to 13 hours. Now, you think about how nuts that is. Like, if you were born the same year as Jesus, it would take 1,500 years for everything that there is to know in the world to double. If you were born at 6 a.m. this morning, it would have doubled by the end of dinner. So, thought number one. We have more information than ever before. That's not shocking, is it? For good reasons, ours is called the information age. Okay? Secondly, Thomas Friedman, a journalist for the New York Times, in his best-selling book, Thank You for Being Late, he writes about what he calls the age of acceleration. And the idea is that everything is speeding up to breakneck speed, that technology is increasing faster than the human capacity to adapt to it. As human beings, we cannot keep up with the pace of change. And this has created a sociological and psychological phenomenon where at least a low level of anxiety is the new normal. Many of us feel like we are chronically behind the curve. Like we're running to play catch up, exhausted by all the change, right? I wasn't going to say this. I'm just throwing this in. This is just a bonus. You guys, Kate and I coached our 7th grade girls basketball team at Voyager Middle School with one player who had ever played basketball before. We went 7-3. Yes. Okay, but here's the thing. I'm hanging around with middle school girls, and I'm like, man, I got to be cool. You guys know how hard it is to be cool? It changes like every week. And here's the thing. One of the girls, I walked into the gym, and Jen was really good at coming to the game, so we walked into the gym together. And one of the girls says to Kate, she says, "Coach, how in the world did your dad pull your mom?" So Kate told me this, and I was like, "Thanks for that." And we're hanging around the kitchen, and I said, "Well, I'll just have to tell the girls, hey, listen, I got game." Right? And so Brooklyn was like, "No, don't say that, Dad. That's not cool." So I'm like, "Well, what do I say?" And she's like, "You got to tell them you got Riz." So the next game, we're having our little pregame meeting, and Kate's going through all this stuff, and then she's like, "You got anything to add, Coach?" I'm like, "One thing." Like, girls, I need all eyes on me. I'm like, this is really important. I heard that someone said, you know, "Coach, how did your dad pull your mom?" So I looked at him and I said, "I need you guys to understand this." And they're like, "Uh-oh." Like, I was like, "I got Riz." And you guys, they were like, "Oh!" And they stood up, they grabbed their cell phones, they throwing them in my face. I'm like, "Say it again, do it again, do it again." That is the last time in the history of my life I will ever be cool with seventh graders, I think. Our world's changing so fast, right? Like, whatever. That isn't going to be the cool thing next week. It's probably not even the cool thing now. And this is what we feel like. We're running to play catch up. We're exhausted by all the change. No matter how much we know or how much we do, it's not enough. Like, you can't know all you need to know. Do you ever feel like everyone else knows stuff you don't know? And you can't do all that you need to do? I mean, do you feel that? So Fuller recognized that we have more information than ever before. Friedman adds that we feel overwhelmed by all the information. It's overwhelming. Okay, finally, Neil Postman, a cultural commentator from NYU, wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in it, he coined the phrase information to action ratio. So with overwhelming levels of info just flooding over us, we can't or don't do anything about most of it, right? So he writes this about our modern age, and he's like, this is weird. He says, the tie between information and action has been severed. Information is now a commodity that can be bought and sold or used as a form of entertainment or worn like a garment to enhance one's status. It comes indiscriminately, directed at no one in particular, disconnected from usefulness. We are glutted with information, drowning in information, have no control over it, don't know what to do with it. It's just fascinating. He points to a particular invention as really the beginning of all of this, but it's not what you might think. It's not the personal computer. It's not the internet, Wi-Fi, smartphones, social media. It's not TikTok. He points to a much earlier invention, the telegraph, as the turning point. Because with the telegraph, for the first time, information, in particular news, could travel across the world at lightning speed. And so news, for the first time ever, became disconnected from your time and place. Prior to that, pretty much the only news you heard was local, right? It was from your town. The odds were your town wasn't a megacity. It was a town with just a few hundred people. And so if you heard bad news, it was usually by word of mouth. Right? It's like, hey, Joe's barn is on fire. And if you heard that, what would you do? Well, you wouldn't start a hashtag, right? No more barn fires on our watch, right? You wouldn't post on social media, our generation will stop barn fires. You wouldn't attend a lecture series or start a blog about barn fires. What would you do? You grab a bucket, right? And you run to Joe's house and you help put out the fire. The point is, you could do something about most of the news you heard. Today, we hear all kinds of news from all over the world, and often, most of the time, the vast majority of the time, we have zero ability to do anything about it. Okay, and so Postman says, what that creates in the human psyche is this new human state where we're used to hearing all kinds of information, could be news or self-help stuff or psychology or science or health, whatever. But we hear information and we can be really moved by it. But then it's very normal for us to do absolutely nothing about it. And Postman says that we now have a dangerously low information to action ratio because this is the new normal. So let me recap. Three ideas. Number one, we have more information than ever before. Number two, we feel overwhelmed by all the information. And number three, we're used to hearing information and then doing absolutely nothing about it. But for Jesus, if you want to apprentice under him, if you want to begin to experience kingdom life in what he called the kingdom of the heavens, the reality of what God is up to right now on earth on into eternity, then when it comes to his words, his teaching, you cannot have a low information to action ratio. So let's just work our way through this passage and how he ends just the greatest speech, most impactful speech in human history. Verse 24, he says, therefore, okay, meaning in light of all I've just said, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine, now by these words of mine, Jesus means the Sermon on the Mount, right? This, the, the Sermon on the Mount, it doesn't contain everything that Jesus said and taught, but when it comes to his teaching, it is by far the most complete collection that we have in one place. So if you want to know how to live the way of Jesus, like if you want to know how to participate in what God is doing on earth, Matthew chapters 5 to 7 is like the foundation of Jesus' vision for human flourishing. So Jesus says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. So it's crazy. Like the goal is to put them into practice, to act on them, to live them, to obey them, to build your life upon them. And you and I, we really need to get our minds around what Jesus is saying. He's saying it's not enough to just hear all that he says, to know the words of his sermon, like maybe take notes, maybe ponder it, maybe mull it over. That's all good, but it's not enough. At the end of all of that, you and I need to actually go out and do it. We need to act on it. We need to live it. Jesus is saying if you and I want to apprentice under him, if we're serious about beginning to live into his vision for human flourishing, we cannot treat his words the way we do most other information in our world right now, with a low information to action ratio. Now, to drive his point home, he tells a parable about life in the kingdom. He describes how life actually works. He names reality. He says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. So this is a contrast between two kinds of people, right? Two home builders. Now we tend to think of this as like a good person versus a bad person. But the comparison isn't good versus bad. It's wise versus foolish. One home builder is wise, the other is foolish. So the word translated wise could also be translated smart, intelligent, thoughtful, enlightened. The word translated foolish could also be translated stupid, unintelligent, not thoughtful, unenlightened. And so Jesus contrasts two distinct home builders. And in this metaphor, your house is your life. In Jesus' day, a home was even more important than in our day. I mean, for one thing, most homes were not like single family. Okay, they were multi-generational. So a lot of people were counting on this place for life and shelter and community. Also, most of the time you ran your business out of your home, you know, farming or fishing or shepherding or whatever. So your house came to symbolize your life as a whole. And here, Jesus says, a wise person builds their life on the foundation of his words. In contrast, the foolish person, they may really like Jesus' words, but they walk away from them and never actually live them. Now notice, Jesus doesn't say why. Maybe they're tired. Maybe they're busy. Maybe they're distracted. Maybe they prefer other teachings even more. Jesus doesn't say, and I think that's brilliant. Because there are all kinds of reasons people might hear his words and then walk away and not put them into practice. So he lets you and I find ourselves in the story. In this parable, it's like, in this parable, which home builder am I? Am I the wise one? Or am I the foolish one? And here's, you guys, here's the really disturbing thing about Jesus' story. You ready for something disturbing? In the short term, you can't tell the difference between the houses. Like from a distance, both houses look pretty much the same. Like they're decorated well, the yard's mowed. They look quite nice, actually. Jesus is making a critical point. In the short term, looking at two lives, they might look very similar. Two people might have the same job, Microsoft or Boeing or teaching or Google or construction or preschool or you know, electrical or whatever. And they might both go to the same gym and work out and be pretty shredded. They might eat at the same places. They might like the same things. They might like the same food and drinks. They might both have labradoodles or cats or gerbils or whatever. So from a distance, the two lives or two houses look basically the same. You can hardly tell them apart until the flood comes. And Jesus is saying in the short term, you can't tell them apart, but everything gets exposed when the flood comes. Okay, a sudden diagnosis, a tragedy, the loss of a loved one, unemployment, the death of a dream, bad news, some kind of a catastrophe. A flood washes into our life and everything gets exposed when we get hit with that hardship. And notice, for Jesus, it's not if a flood comes, it's when a flood comes. The flood will come. And for some of you I know, and some of you I don't know, but it's flooding right now. But even if things are pretty good for you right now, I'm just here to encourage you. There's a flood coming. And you guys, I love that Jesus is honest about the realities of how hard life is. This is part of what makes Jesus' teaching ring so true to me. Like in the day of the self-help and unhelpful pep talk, Jesus is aware of reality and he's down to earth. He's like, here, let me tell you something. Life is hard. Whether you follow him or not, it's hard. The wise person and the fool go through the same flood. Those that build their life upon practicing the way of Jesus and those that do not build their life on practicing the way of Jesus, both will eventually go through a flood. Now, sometimes like immature followers of Jesus and false teachers, they deny this. They believe and they teach that if you live faithfully, if you do the right things, then God will spare you from all hardship. It's called the prosperity gospel or the health and wealth gospel. The idea is that if you believe enough and if you talk positively and if you live righteously, God will bless you financially and in your physical well-being, and he will make your life happy and prevent you from suffering. You guys, that is a crisis of faith waiting to happen. Because life contains floods. It just does. This world is broken. There's pain, there's grief, there's loss, there's death and suffering for everybody. Someday, something will shake the house of your life to the core. And what Jesus wants us to see is that the flood will reveal what your life is actually built upon. If your life is built on greed or on materialism and acquiring stuff or on competition, getting ahead, outshining other people, getting ahead no matter the cost, if it's built around sex or youth or beauty, if it's built around your appearance, if it's built on popularity, how many people follow you, if it's built on hedonism, pleasure, if that's how you define the good life, if it's built on travel and eating and drinking and adventure, being able to go anywhere, do anything you want, if it's built on safety and predictability, knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, if it's built on any of that kind of stuff, the flood will wipe it out. Jesus is offering you and me a new way to be human. And it's a way that lived into can withstand the various floods of life. Jesus said, it's a way that will keep your house from crashing down. It's a way, it isn't just a way that we hear and mull over and recite to other people. It's a way that we live. So I just want to say the invitation of Jesus is not to pray a prayer one day, right? Like to go to Christian camp and get saved and pray the right prayer and then spend the rest of your life ignoring the teachings of Jesus. Just relying on the reality that you prayed that prayer once, and so one day you can go to heaven when you die. It is crazy to me how widespread this idea has become in our culture. That there's a huge number of people who sincerely believe you can be a Christian without following Jesus. That's not the invitation. Also, the invitation isn't to like attend church a little bit and be a cultural Christian, like learning how to use Christian language and lingo and put Christian decorations, cute little decorations in your house, and do a few religious things along the way. There's a big difference between a cultural Christian and someone sincerely apprenticing in the way of Jesus. And you guys know this, right? You've seen it. And when do you see it most? Well, you see it when someone gets hit with a flood. I mean, for the apprentice of Jesus, the flood is still hard, right? For the apprentice of Jesus, there's still fear and sadness and loss and grief, but it doesn't bring their house crashing to the ground. Jesus and his way of life, they're a solid foundation. He says, you can rest your feet here. And right now, some of you are desperate for that, right? Because things that you once stood upon in your life, they're being stripped away. It feels like chaos. And in your pain, our world shouts conflicting messages to you. Again, we live in a day and age where, number one, we have more information than ever before. Number two, we feel overwhelmed by all the information. And number three, we're used to hearing information and then doing nothing about it. You can't possibly respond to all the teaching that's out there. You can't possibly please all of the shouting voices. You just can't. Jesus is offering you a pretty simple solution. He's saying, here's what you do. You just listen for one singular voice. You build your life on a single way, Jesus and his way. Now, does that sound crazy? Well, it depends on who you think Jesus is. Depends on what kind of authority you think Jesus has. I mean, look at how the crowds responded to Jesus' sermon. It's really easy to kind of read past this last part as sort of like this add-on. But here's what it says. This is when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. Why? Because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. So the rabbinic style of the day was to just go around quoting other rabbis who came before you. In fact, that's still like the rabbinic style in Judaism to this day. Your authority was vested in those who came before you. So it would be like, well, Rabbi so-and-so said, right, and whatever it would be. But Rabbi Jesus never did that once. You never read Jesus saying, well, Rabbi so-and-so said. Jesus would stand up and say, truly I tell you, and boom, he would drop a truth bomb. He would stand up and name reality. He would put language to the way life actually works. He would paint a picture with words of reality, and it would ring true to those that were listening. Now, the word or label for that kind of resonance with reality is authority. And guys, in our culture, we've become really averse to authority. But for Jesus, his authority wasn't rooted in a title or in some org chart. It wasn't rooted in his gender or some oppressive system. His authority was simply rooted in the truth of his words and his life example. I love Eugene Peterson's translation of those last two verses. He says, when Jesus concluded his address, the crowd burst into applause. They had never heard teaching like this. It was apparent that he was living everything he was saying, quite a contrast to the religion teachers. This was the best teaching they had ever heard. The most potent kind of spiritual authority, it has nothing to do with a degree. It has nothing to do with your title or where you studied. The most potent kind of spiritual authority is when you speak truth and people hear it and it corresponds with reality. And it corresponds with how you live your own life. Because Jesus had that kind of authority. Jesus claimed to be far more than like a sage or a rabbi or an enlightened person. He claimed to be far more than just a conduit of the truth. Jesus of Nazareth claimed to be the source of truth itself. And you think about what he says about himself just in the closing of this speech, going back to what we looked at 2 weeks ago. He claims that on Judgment Day, people will say to him, Lord, Lord. On Judgment Day, people, let's think about that. On Judgment Day, people will say to Jesus from Nazareth, Lord, Lord. Because that's what you call God. He claims that on Judgment Day, people that don't know him will be sent away from him. Again, not sent away from God, sent away from him. And then think about this. He has the audacity to claim that his teaching is the foundation that you should construct your entire life upon. That is so arrogant. Because if I said something like that, you should run. And here's the thing. No rabbi would ever say that. Never. A good rabbi would say that the scriptures are the foundation, that the Torah is the foundation to build your life on. No rabbi would ever have the audacity to say, actually, my teaching is even more important than the Torah. Like, my interpretation of scripture is more important than the scripture itself. My teaching and my way are the foundation to construct your entire life upon. I mean, think about that. That kind of talk is ridiculous. It's utterly delusional unless you're like God and humanity in the same mind and body. Unless your authority is rooted in being the one who set the cosmos into motion, the one who designed and fashioned the human psyche, the one who knows fully how human beings are designed to flourish. That's the claim. The question is, what are you and I going to do with it? Again, your house is your life. Everybody builds a house. You can't not. You have to build a life. You are building a life. The question is not, are you building a house or a life? The question is, what are you building your house or your life upon? What Jesus is teaching here is more than ideology, you know, some set of ideas that you ascribe to. It's more than a set of beliefs that affirm, a set of beliefs to affirm if somebody asks. It's a way of life, and it affects how you and I do everything. It can and should be applied everywhere at all times. Now, please don't understand me, or misunderstand me. Please do understand me. Please don't misunderstand me. Here's what I'm not saying. Okay, I'm not saying unless you hear Jesus' words one time and immediately experience total life transformation and live them perfectly, you aren't a real follower of Jesus. I mean, Jesus paints for us a picture that's beautiful. It's also incredibly hard to live out. It's not natural. It's not how the world lives, and it will require a lifetime of apprenticeship to Jesus. It will. You don't just read something one time like, don't worry, right? And be like, oh, cool, I'll stop doing that. You know, or don't look at a woman with lustful intent. Don't objectify women. You're like, oh, yeah, right, Jesus, done. Boom, never do that again. Let go of anger, hate, bitterness. Love your enemies. Done. Anger, bitterness, they'll never have a place in my heart again. I mean, living into Jesus' way, it requires a lifetime of committed apprenticeship to him. But he wants us to realize, unless you actually build your life on it, you're missing out on the opportunity of your lifetime, okay? So let's just do a little quick self-assessment. Underneath the day-to-day activity, what is the bedrock of your life being built upon? What is the foundation for you right now? Is it Jesus and discovering and practicing his way of being human? Or in reality, is it being built on something else? And if it's something else, what is it? What is the way that you're living? And who is it that's teaching you this way? I mean, you think about your world right now. What voices do you need to turn down? In your life, which voices need the volume to go down? Maybe there's a voice telling you lies about the world. It just doesn't correspond to reality, but that lie has had your ear. Or maybe it's a voice telling you what matters most in this world, telling you how to be happy, but the voice is wrong. It needs to be turned down. Maybe it's a voice telling you who you need to be somebody that matters, what you need to do to do or be to be valuable. A voice that's causing insecurity or fear or jealousy. The voice could be your mom or your dad. It might be social media. Could be a friend, a group of friends, group of coworkers. It might be a sibling or a neighbor or a roommate. It also could just be an inner voice that speaks to you often. You don't even know where it comes from, but you know you need to turn down the volume. Like, what voices do you need to turn down? Okay, second question. What voices do you need to turn up? Who in your life is speaking the truth and life of Jesus to you these days? And how can you turn that voice up? I mean, obviously, Jesus speaks to us through Scripture, particularly through the Gospels and his words, but also, Jesus speaks to us through people or community, yeah? Yeah. I mean, his voice, amazingly, for 2,000 years, has fanned out through the voices of his people to one another. So what person or community in your world needs a bigger voice? How can you move toward that person or those people? Who's speaking the truth and life of Jesus to you these days? And how can you give that voice more volume in your life? Okay, and then last question. Is there a community for you that helps you hear Jesus? And how can you take a step toward that community? Like, how can you find a place where you're not all alone in this? How can you initiate movement toward community? So maybe you reach out to somebody. You set up a get-together, maybe even a regular get-together. Or maybe you talk on the phone with somebody who needs a bigger voice in your life. Or maybe you organize something that facilitates community. Maybe you gather people in some way, but you take initiative. So what voice or voices do you need to turn down? What voices do you need to turn up? And how can you learn to live the way of Jesus in community? I mean, part of what we do in community is we remember who Jesus is. I feel like I need to be reminded just as much as I need to be instructed. I forget the most important things. And so we remember Jesus in community. And one of the ways that we do that is through communion. And so we're going to do that today. We're just going to be reminded of his love for us, his goodness to us. We're going to think about what it is to apprentice to him. So we're going to close the service here in a little bit with 20, 25 minutes worth of worship. And the bread and the juice are available both sides in the back. I think we have gluten-free is in the back. Is that true? Gluten-free is in the back if you need that. You don't need to be a member here or to have taken a class. Like, you're welcome. If you want to apprentice to Jesus and learn his way from him, then I'd just say come. The bread represents his body broken for us. Juice represents his blood shed for us. And you can come at any time that it makes sense for you during the closing set. But I want to say one more thing. Actually, two more things. So don't hold me to the one more. If you want to become an apprentice of Jesus and you want to learn his way from him, is there like a concrete way to say to Jesus, I'm in? Like, I want to live into and out of your teaching. I want to follow you. I want to learn from you. I want to build my life on you. Is there a definitive way to say, Jesus, I'm in for this? Like, I offer you my life. I'm in. Well, different expressions of Christianity have used various means to signal this over the years, right? I mean, for some, it's coming forward at the end of a church service. For some, it's a prayer that you pray. For some, it's raising your hand. And those are all good things, okay? Those are all legit things. But in the New Testament, in the Bible, the one definitive way to say to Jesus, I'm in, is to be what? To be baptized. A baptism is a way to identify with Jesus' life and his teachings and his death and his resurrection. It's a statement to God saying, I'm in for all of this. But baptism, the key with this is baptism is the first step, not the last. You say yes to following Jesus through baptism, and then you spend the rest of your life figuring out what that means and living into it. And that includes working through questions and doubts and habits and struggles. You don't have to have everything figured out to be baptized. If it required that, I'm just going to let you in. No one would ever get baptized. You just have to say, Jesus, I want to learn and grow and mature, and I trust you, and I trust your authority, and I want to learn your way and live it. So heal me and teach me and make me new. I'm in for this. As Jen said, we're doing a baptism, right, during the brunch, April 7th, and this year we already have several adults being baptized. If you're an adult and you're like, last time it was all kids and I would stand out, there's lots of other adults getting baptized. And you guys, here's what I can't wait. I mean, that casserole is so good. But also, I mean, I can't wait to help people get it started on their spiritual journey or whatever. I can't wait. And for some of you right now, even in this room, like, it's your time. It's your time. So if that's the case, reach out. You can use your Connect card that's on your chair. You can do your online Connect card. You can, you know, text the number. You can email me, text me if you have my contact info. You can email or text Jen if you have her contact info. Just let us know. And even if you're not sure, if you're like, I'm not really sure, I'll talk through it with you. And those are conversations I can't wait to have. So seriously, maybe it's your time. Okay, to end, truly, this is the last thing. To end, again, your house is your life. Everybody builds a life. You can't not. You have to build a life. You are building a life. The question is not, are you building, you know, your house or your life? The question is, what are you building your house upon? And underneath it all, what is really the bedrock of your life being built upon? Is it Jesus and practicing his way to be human, or is it built on something that's not going to survive the flood? Jesus ends the greatest teaching in human civilization, not with a pep talk, not with a rah-rah, like, go out and change the world, guys. Not with an encouraging poem that stirs everybody's heart. Not with a funny story and a laugh. He ends it with a sober warning. Like a loving father screaming to his child running toward the street, he closes his manifesto, declaring a new way to be human with this. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Mic drop. Speech done. Sermon over. Boom. Can you guys imagine if I ended a sermon like that? Some of you would never come back. Just that abruptly, like, why doesn't he do something more positive? So try to imagine a hypothetical scenario. I gave the best teaching you've ever heard in your life. This is hypothetical. Very hypothetical. But I mean, you guys, it was brilliant. And you are blown away at my authority, meaning that what I'm saying corresponds to reality and it corresponds to how I'm actually living my life. And then I ended the message this way. I said, okay, guys, everyone who hears these words of mine, everything I just said in this message and puts them into practice is like a wise person who built their house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the wind blew and beat against that house, and yet it did not fall. Like, you faced the worst hardship of your life, and yet you were fine. In fact, more than fine. The flood came and revealed to you and in you and to the world around you the very best of who you are. You were fine. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash.